I'm JP Tuesday.
And I'm Kiki Cannon. We've been Disney fans our entire lives. And now, as childless adults, we're undertaking a journey through the media that shaped our lives.
Trying to find out if what made them special is still there.
We are Rewatching the Magic.
Hi, Kiki.
Hi.
Oh, well, what's wrong? You're not feeling too good today?
You made me watch a dog die 4 times today.
Yeah. My bad.
We're going to have words when this recording goes off.
But you said you wanted to talk about something before we talked all about that, before, you know.
Yeah, there is other Disney news we got to get to. So right. I got a theory.
Mm-hmm.
My theory is that either we are psychic or someone at Disney listens to our podcast.
I'd be surprised if someone at Disney listens to this podcast.
Then we are psychic! For the second time now, we have talked about something on the show that happened within like 2 weeks after we talked about it.
Yeah, first was the Princess and the Frog Splash Mountain remake. And
this week, we find out that after all of our complaining in the Peter Pan episode about there not being any warnings for anything harsher than tobacco, Disney is now adding cultural sensitivity warnings to at least 6 to begin with of its classic films.
You want to go down that list?
Including Peter Pan.
Yeah.
Yeah, the list as it stands so far is Peter Pan, The Jungle Book, Lady and the Tramp, The Aristocats, Dumbo, and Swiss Family Robinson. The movies will now start out with a Disney Plus advisory, and there will also be an explanation of what the negative depictions are, why they are offensive, and any other cultural context Disney feels needs to be there. But the blanket advisory that will appear before all of the movies reads as follows. This program includes negative depictions and or mistreatment of people or cultures. These stereotypes were wrong then and are wrong now. Rather than remove this content, we want to acknowledge its harmful impact, learn from it, and spark conversation to create a more inclusive future together. Disney is committed to creating stories with inspirational and aspirational themes that reflect the rich diversity of the human experience around the globe. To learn more about how these stories have impacted society, please visit, and then it gives a Disney website that you can go to look at for further context.
It's a start.
It is a start, and I am very much, and we've talked about this before, I am very much not one that says, generally, pull this forever. We have kind of talked about that with Song of the South, because honestly, there's not really anything redeeming in that movie.
Mm.
But, and we've talked about Peter Pan too, but I do think that in a lot of these other movies, in Dumbo, in Swiss Family Robinson, in The Aristocats, all that there are redeeming elements, good things, hopeful things, fun things. And then, unfortunately, you know, you get Minstrel Crows or something.
These movies were someone's childhood. So, yeah, I've said this before. I am all for these movies being on Disney Plus in their original format, for better or worse, and having a warning ahead of them saying that they will have outdated cultural references. Yeah, I'm all for that. And the fact they're saying that they were wrong then and they're wrong now, again, that's a plus in my book. I like it, and who knows what, you know, there's probably more movies on there and more movies to come that will likely need that kind of explanation, especially some of the older movies.
Yeah, I never think that we should run from our history in any kind of sense. And the acknowledgement that it was wrong then, I think, is very important, because a lot of companies that do this sort of thing want to be like, Well, these depictions were a product of our time and were considered acceptable then, but now are not... No, there were people already telling you then that this was unacceptable. Just didn't listen to them. So I appreciate the Disney Corporation saying, like, no, it was absolutely wrong when it was done. It continues to be wrong now. And we want to try to... maybe not make up for that, but at least acknowledge that.
Yeah, acknowledge that it was wrong. And that's a start. Again, it's a start. Let's see where it goes from there. And yeah, kudos to Disney on this one.
Yeah. Good job, Disney. We appreciate it. So, you know, good work. Do better in future, you know, with your future movies. It's really all we can ask.
Yeah. So now that that's out of the way, let's talk about a dead dog. I can't tell if that's you growling or your dog growling.
Both.
So yeah, let's talk Tim Burton's Frankenweenie. The movie that Tim Burton made twice.
A movie so good he made it twice and killed the dog four times.
So yeah, Tim Burton, we've talked about Tim Burton on the show before. How he started at CalArts, went to Disney as an animator, was given a chance to make a few shorts of his own. He made one called Victor about, Vincent, that was the name of it. Vincent, yeah. About a young Vincent Price, his idol. And he made Frankenweenie. And he got fired for it.
Yeah, this was the movie that got Tim Burton fired from Disney. They claimed that it was a gross misallocation of resources and that it was far too scary to be shown to children.
And a year after that came out, they did Return to Oz.
Yeah.
And the Black Cauldron.
And Black Cauldron. And then not too long after this, before the 80s were out, they would also do Watcher in the Woods. Which is unfortunately not on Disney Plus, so we will not be doing it this month, but hopefully it will be up on Disney Plus by this time next year so that we can talk about that movie, because I want to talk about that movie. So Disney made a lot worse things than this short. This short is actually rather adorable.
Yeah.
Despite sad... concept of it. This is a really adorable short.
Yeah, and the artistic use of this being in black and white. Granted, yeah, it is a full-on homage to the classic monster movies of the 1930s that, you know, very likely Tim Burton grew up on in the, 60s, 70s?
Yeah, it would have been the 60s. But this is fascinating to me because this is basically Disney, at least the Disney name, doing a loving homage and parody of the Universal monster franchise.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, one of the bigger and most enduring Universal properties. It definitely was probably their biggest in the 80s when this was filmed.
Yeah.
Those
were aired on TV every Halloween. Even to this day, you can still go on like AMC and watch the classic horror movies.
Absolutely. So I love that he was like, I don't care if I work for Disney. I want to do a love letter to Universal.
Yeah, and this was going to be theatrically aired with, I believe, the re-release of The Jungle Book. Can you imagine in 1984 going to see The Jungle Book and you see this?
Yeah, I'm not sure how I would have taken this film if I had gone to see a completely different stylistic movie. You know, something happy like The Jungle Book,
mm-hmm.
and then got this in front of it, like completely with no warning.
Yeah.
But I loved this short when I was younger. But granted, for me, when I was introduced to this short was maybe about age 15 or I found the VHS in a rental store. My favorite rental store had a massive horror collection, and all kinds of like really obscure stuff. And they had the VHS for this, and I rented it and watched it several times. And I already liked Tim Burton by that point because I was already familiar with several of his other films. And so it was kind of interesting to see like baby Tim Burton's first film.
Yeah, and after he, again, when we talked about this, he got fired for this, and this kind of stood in the Disney vault for years, and then Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Beetlejuice, Batman, Edward Scissorhands. Disney's like, well, Tim Burton's the hot guy in Hollywood right now. We have his first film. Let's release it anyway and try to make some money off of it. And yeah, it was released on video, and there we are.
The thing I had forgotten about this that my dog is annoyed that we're talking about dogs without him. The thing that shocked me about this when I did the rewatch was I had forgotten that the three main people in here were all either were known actors at the time or became big name actors right after this.
Yeah, so let's kind of get into the cast since we're already on that. The main character, Victor himself, being played by Barrett Oliver, aka Bastion from the Neverending Story.
Yeah.
Bastion, say Bastion. My name!
Yeah. You can't hear that name without doing that if you're our age, I think.
Yeah. And considering that Neverending Story was another one of those 80s kids movies that scared the hell out of us.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and also massive animal death.
Yeah.
Oh.
Please. Oh.
Yeah. You if you've seen the Neverending Story, you know what scene we're talking about.
Yeah, but this would have been filmed, the Frankenweenie short was filmed either right after Neverending Story came out or just before it came out, but after he had filmed it.
So this was 84 because when it was filmed. Because they were filmed
very, very close together. Yeah. Then the one that kind of shocked me, and probably the biggest name at the time, is we've got Shelley Duvall as the mother.
Yeah.
Probably best known for her performance as Wendy Torrance in The Shining. But of course, a lot of people, in our generation do remember her like adorable, you know, sit down and read us a story fairy tale theater that she did. Yeah, and that's such a big part of my childhood is seeing her, you know, doing fairy tale theater. And then the other one that
I want to say, you know, the thing about Shelley Duvall is that she already has the Disney connection because she did Popeye.
Yeah, she had done Popeye by this point. Yeah.
So I think that was just she was already working with Disney at the time, so why not? She was available.
Yeah, that is, I had forgotten about that. You are correct. The one that I'm not sure how big his name would have been at the time is the person who played the father, which would have been Daniel Stern.
Yeah. Home Alone hadn't come out yet.
Home Alone had not come out yet. And also, he had been in a Woody Allen movie before this. And right about the same time, he was going to have a part in the horror movie Chud. But those weren't, like, big breakthrough roles. He had his biggest role to this point had been in a movie called Diner. But I think that was kind of more like an artsy, like people in the industry might have been into that movie, but I'm not sure how big that was in the cultural zeitgeist. And then, of course, after doing this movie, he would go on to do the Home Alone movies. The most important thing in the connection to this movie was that he would go on to be the narrator for The Wonder Years, along with a kid who has a minor blink and you'll miss it role in this short, Jason Hervey, who played Wayne, the older brother in Wonder Years.
Yeah,
but this was before.
He plays one of Victor's friends in this one.
Yeah, but this was before they did Wonder Years. Wonder Years would be a couple of years later. So it's kind of funny that this was the first time they worked together on a project.
And one that shocked me, a very young Sofia Coppola is in this movie.
Yeah, when she was still trying to be an actress. I think she got broken of that after Godfather 2 or 3 or whichever one she was in, and she got savaged for her performance. But she's good in this one. She doesn't have a very big role, but she's very good as this kind of like jazzercise obsessed preteen girl.
Typical 80s kid.
Yeah, she's like a really cute, you know, she's got a really Barbie and she's trying to make Barbie do jazzercise and stuff.
She's the only character in this movie that acts like an 80s kid, because everyone kind of dresses like they're in the 50s. The cars are all 50s style cars.
Well, this takes place in the Tim Burton time of the 1950s, 70s. It's some sort of nebulous Americana time that takes place somewhere between the 50s and the early 70s, like pre-disco 70s.
Yeah, that's pretty much every Burton movie. And
that's honestly every Tim Burton film. It's you know, this, you could have filmed Edward Scissorhands on this set. You could have filmed several of his other films, you know, parts of like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah.
On this set, you know. So Tim Burton, just unless the script absolutely calls for it to be in some particular other time, like Ed Wood being a biopic was very, you know, it had to be set in L.A. at a specific time. And Sweeney Todd has to be in a kind of Edwardian, Victorian, somewhere in there kind of setting, you know, in England. But when he's able to just set things whenever he wants, it's a vague Americana sometime when Tim Burton was a little boy.
Pretty much
is the setting. But you know, I am going to say this just in general, because the same can be said about the feature length film as well. I respect a filmmaker that has a very specific and unique vision. If you see a Tim Burton film, you're going to know it's a Tim Burton film just from a single frame. And I kind of respect that strict, I know who I am. Sometimes being the jack of all trades really is the master of none. And so some people are like, oh, you know, the versatility of this artist, and you'd never know it was one of his films if it wasn't, you know, on the screen. And I'm thinking, yeah, but who are you as an artist? You know?
The only time I ever felt that this doesn't feel like a Tim Burton movie would have been Dumbo.
Yeah, there are bits in that. But even at points, you're like, ooh, this feels super Tim Burton-y.
Yeah. So let's get into the short, Frankenweenie 1984. So we have our young Victor Frankenstein. The fact that he's still called Victor Frankenstein.
Yeah,
he's a filmmaker.
And he's a filmmaker. Yeah.
Geez, Tim Burton doing about a movie about a kid that's a filmmaker? I have no idea where he would get that idea from. No.
Yeah, he's got him a little, like, 16mm camera, and he makes little short monster movies starring his dog. And it's adorable.
Yeah, it's cute. I mean, it sounds like something that Tim Burton would have done as a kid. He probably did. It's in a storage facility somewhere.
Yeah. A lot of the filmmakers that kind of came out of this era had that similar thing because they grew up in the era, you know, late 50s, early 60s was kind of when home movies were a thing that was accessible to the middle class. Mm. Being able to film things was no longer just the purview of the massive rich anymore. And so a lot of filmmakers that hit it big in the 80s grew up with these little 16mm film cameras that they didn't record any sound and all, but they made these kind of short, silent movies. And so I can definitely see that was probably Tim Burton's childhood.
Mm. So yeah, we got Victor, and after showing his latest movie where his dog plays this monster from space, he starts playing with his dog Sparky in the front yard with a little ball, and the ball runs into the street, and Sparky goes after the ball, and this is where Kiki gets mad at me.
Yeah. You can already hear Bowie is mad at you. He's just howling in the background because
yes, yes. Critics. So yeah,
It's done as tastefully as you can do an animal death, though.
We never see the car hit Sparky. It switches to POV, where just the camera is Sparky's eyes, which also plays into the fact that the movie's black and white, because that old myth of the dogs can't see colors.
Yeah, that is. I hadn't thought about that, but you're right. Yeah. So. After the unfortunate car accident, we have a nice little funeral in a pet cemetery.
The way this pet cemetery looks, it looks like they just made some tombstones out of cardboard and put them in a park somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, despite this having the Disney name and saying that he used too many Disney resources, this really looks like a film you and your friends would have put together on a weekend.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks very, very cheap. And other than the fact that there's at least a couple of actors who you recognize in it, you're like, ooh, this is somebody's student film.
Yeah. So, yeah. Victor is not taking the death of Sparky very well. He's distracted in class. He's just drawing his dog. He's not even paying attention to the teacher. Until they bring out Ye Olde Dead Frog.
Yeah.
Has ceased to be! It has joined the choir invisible! This is an ex-frog! That is what went through my head.
I don't think Disney owns the BBC yet, so.
Well, when he came on and said that this is an ex-frog, that was the first thing that went through my head.
Yeah. I like that he also, I can't remember which version it's in, but one of the little girls in class goes, ew, and he goes, well, no scientists in this class. So, I like that. That was very much my high school science class. I don't know if it was for you, but it was like they would bring out the dead whatever, and some, like, one of the little, like, adorable little pretty cheerleader girls would go like, ah! And everybody else would just look at her like, shut up.
It's already dead. You're not going to really hurt its feelings. But yeah, I mean, that's been a thing, a controversial subject in schools for many years, was the use of dead animals, especially frogs, in science class for dissection.
I never did a frog. I did pigs.
Hmm.
Yeah. Baby pigs.
Ooh.
Yeah.
So, they do the, okay, the frog isn't going to move because it's dead, but they make that the circulatory system is still there. So when lightning is applied, movement can happen. Yeah. That sparks young Victor, gives him an idea. Lightning.
The interesting thing about the use of the frog in the class is this is historically accurate as to what led to the discovery of bioelectricity and the galvanic responses in the body, is that there was a scientist who hooked a dead frog up to electricity and made its legs twitch, and it became like the big thing. Go see this dude and his dead frog with the twitching legs, and it led to like the whole, you know, study of electricity in the body. So this is actually relatively historically accurate as to what led to these, you know, this branch of science in the first place.
Yeah, so Victor is just obsessed with this idea of putting electricity through a dead body to reanimate it. Like, he runs home. He doesn't even bother to wait for his mother to cook dinner. He's grabbing every electrical appliance in the house to plug it up to.
Yeah, he's got like a toaster, a radio, every lamp in the house.
Christmas decorations.
He's
bringing in stuff from the garage just to hook it all up. And yes, he does go to the pet cemetery and digs up Sparky's body.
Here's my problem with both of the films.
Mm-hmm.
Sparky is covered in stitches.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's just a reference to the classic Frankenstein look itself.
And it is, but the reason that, you know, the monster and all the Frankenstein stuff has that look is because it was supposed to be an amalgamation of several bodies.
Mm-hmm.
That you take the good parts from various bodies, you stitch them together, you create a thing that was never one being to begin with, and then you bring it to life.
Mm-hmm.
This is just Sparky. So the only thing that leads to is that car accident mangled this poor thing, and they tried to resuscitate it and do surgery on it, and it didn't work.
Yeah.
Which is just even more a horrific, you know, the movie kind of makes it seem like, you know, what car? Orf! And then nothing. But like, this suggests that Sparky went through quite an ordeal before finally giving up the ghost. Which is sad.
So yeah, that's... Yeah, now we have this little, you know, we get to the attic, and Victor is in the attic. The poor fish tank.
Yeah, in the stop motion film, there are no fish in the fish tank. It's just an empty tank with, like, various, like, fake plastic plants and whatever. Mm-hmm. But there are actually live fish swimming around the fish tank in the live action movie.
Yeah. Like, he's hooked up a clock. He's hooked up his bike to be like a generator. Smart kid, this young Victor Frankenstein. He's putting up kites and umbrellas just to, as lightning rods.
I love that he makes a Jacob's ladder out of a home lamp, like out of a bedside lamp, which I love.
Yeah. And luckily for him, it happened to be a thunderstorm that night. As, again, like in the classic Frankenstein story of, you know, being an electrical storm and lightning strikes the body. Live! Give my creature life! Granted, Victor doesn't go that way, but, you know, it's such a trope in science
fiction.
Yeah,
you kind of wanted the Do you kind of wanted to see Bastion screaming that, you know, doing his best impression, but they didn't go that far. They just had him, like, stare up expectantly.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just going to keep calling him Bastion, but yeah. And he, you know, after lightning strikes Sparky, he brings the body down, and there's no heartbeat, there's no movement, and, you know, he, poor Victor tried, and he kind of hugs his dog, apologizing, and like, it's, you know, it's, he tried, and almost like the power of love brought Sparky back to life, because his tail starts wagging, he starts licking Victor's hand. It's a nice little moment.
Yeah.
You know, Sparky's alive.
And how Victor realizes after the elation wears off that, like, uh-oh, he's got a zombie dog in the house and his parents might not want him to have that, so maybe we should keep Sparky a secret for a little bit.
Yeah, he it's very obvious that Victor doesn't sleep this night because he's completely exhausted the next day.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to go to school, I'm sick. You know, I got the flu or something, but of course parents don't buy that, even in this 50s, 70s amalgamation Tim Burton verse.
Yeah.
So there you know. Yeah.
Yeah, but with Victor away from school, Sparky jumps out a window and runs around the neighborhood playing like he used to, but everybody is scared of him. And for some reason, they think that this, like, adorable little bull terrier is, like, a giant wolf or something.
Because they never really get a good look at it. And, yeah, why is it a bull terrier and it's called Frankenweenie?
I don't know. There is a dachshund in the film.
Yes, yes. The
neighbor has a adorable little dachshund, so I don't know.
Frankenterrier probably didn't make it sound very good.
I don't know. The interesting thing is one of the most faithful film adaptations of Frankenstein I've ever seen was Wishbone. And Wishbone is also a terrier. Just a Jack Russell. But yeah, I don't know why the weirdness. Maybe he named it Frankenweenie and then just the best dog actor that he could get a hold of was a bull terrier.
Possibly. So yeah, Sparky starts causing mischief as dogs do. But the neighbors are all freaked out. They confront Victor's parents saying, hey, we don't mind that you got a new dog, but you got to keep him on a leash because he's causing problems. Oh, we didn't get a new dog. We're still mourning Sparky, you know. It probably was like a neighbor dog or a stray cat or something. And Victor's dad goes to check up on Victor to see if anything's going wrong and sees the reanimated Sparky.
Daniel Stern is amazing in this scene because he opens the door and just sees his son playing with his dead dog, which is now covered in scars and running around, and he just like slowly backs out and closes the door.
It must have been a stray cat or something.
Yeah, honey, go downstairs, come inside. Lies to the neighbors.
Honey, you have to see this. And yeah, they're looking and they confront Victor about yeah. Shelley Duvall's just shocked, being like, Victor, what have you done?
Yeah. She's great in that Scream Queen kind of role, but still down to earth, you know?
Yeah. The perfect person to play a mom.
Yeah. She really is very, very matronly in that sense.
Yeah. And Victor's trying to explain, hey, now you don't have to get another dog. We don't have to train another dog. Sparky's back. Isn't it wonderful? Yeah. Oh, kid, you're a cute kid, Victor, but you just, the moral implications of what you've just done.
Yeah, I like that his father actually asked him, do you even understand the implications of what you've done? And the kid just looks at him like, got my dog back? It's like there's no, you know, philosophical and existential crisis about the nature of life and death. He's just like, he can play fetch again. The thing that I like is that the parents, being very naive, go like, oh, if we just introduce the neighborhood to our reanimated zombie dog, they'll be fine with it. So they throw like a cocktail party with Dip.
Yeah, with all of the parents in the neighborhood to kind of explain to them what's going on. And I think we did kind of skip over a scene that it was kind of used in a lot of the advertisements for this movie, was Sparky drinking water and the water shooting out of the seams.
Yeah. Yeah. A scene which we will find again in the stop motion version.
Yeah.
Kudos
to mom here for fixing that stitching.
Yeah, I just love how sweetly Shelley Duvall is just like stitching the dog back together and then like biting the thread to cut it. It's so cute. Okay.
All right. So then they start the party here. You know, everyone's all dressed up, and he tries to you hear Daniel Stern, Dad, explaining, yeah, it's, you know, it's the same Sparky we've always known, and it's, you know, he's back now. Victor, show him. And he brings out Sparky, and everyone goes, that's it, that's the devil dog that attacked my butt, well, my little puppy, and that's the one that scared my daughter. Kill it, kill it. Yeah, so we're just jumping straight to the end of Frankenstein.
Yeah, and they form a mob and chase the dog, who ends up on an abandoned miniature golf course.
Yeah.
And runs into
a windmill.
The adorable little miniature windmill.
Because you gotta recreate that scene from the movie.
Yeah. I loved that. When I saw that as a kid, when they ended up at the miniature golf course, I just died laughing, because in the short film, there is no foreshadowing of that moment.
Yeah.
You never see a miniature golf course, like, you know, they never like ride by the closed miniature golf course on their bikes or anything. There is no foreshadowing of this moment. Until the dog like runs up to the windmill. And as a kid, seeing that for the first time and realizing now where this was going to go, I had to pause the tape and just laugh. Because it was such a brilliant move to me. So,
Victor goes after Sparky to try to get him back. They try to, even though they're holding flashlights, someone uses a cigarette lighter to try to see into the windmill and sets it on fire. Because again, we need to get to that part of the story.
And then the entire town stands by as they roast a boy and his dog alive in a windmill. Like, none of the people, except for the parents, kind of like try to run toward it, and somebody kind of stops them, but they don't really put up too much of a fuss. And then the whole town just kind of stands there watching as this building that they know a kid is inside just burns. They don't try to, like, nobody's going like, oh my god, somebody find water, like nothing. It's just like,
call the fire department. No, none of that.
No, we're just gonna stand here and watch silently as this kid meets his death. But fortunately,
Sparky saves Victor's life, pulling him out of the fire in a very Benji / Lassie moment.
Yeah. We don't deserve dogs. Dogs are the best.
But unfortunately, he's getting all happy, and he backs right back into the windmill as it collapses from the fire with one little yelp from the dog. I had forgotten that was in this movie.
You watched me watch a dog die twice.
Yeah. Yeah. But.
But fortunately, almost roasting a kid alive makes the town people see the error of their ways.
The dog saved the kid's life. He did it once. We can do it again. So they all circle their cars around, hook up their car batteries, rev their engines, give it some juice, and use the power of the car batteries to bring Sparky back to life again.
I mean, it's completely pointless that they're revving their engines, because that's not how car batteries worked.
Tell that to Tim Burton.
I would. Where is he? I would have this conversation with him. I have no fear of Tim Burton. Come at me, Tim Burton.
Yeah, he comes back to life, and we did skip the scene with the poodle from next door. Which
Is there a scene in the short film? They set it up in the feature film, but I don't remember.
Because there's a poodle with Bride of Frankenstein hair.
Yeah.
He may have brushed up against the poodle, and then it shocked the poodle into the Bride of Frankenstein hair.
Again, that's the feature film. In my memory, like I said, I just watched this like 2 hours ago, but in my memory, this came out of nowhere. It's just suddenly a poodle that looks like the Bride of Frankenstein jumps out of a car. And I was like, was that in the thing before? So it may have been. It may have been, but I do not remember that being set up. So maybe I blinked or something.
Yeah, yeah. Because, again, you need to have the Bride of Frankenstein moment in your Frankenstein movie.
Yeah.
And they're snuggling up. Oh, it's love at first sight. It's like, that's it. And then that's how it ends, with Sparky barking very happily as electricity comes out of his little neck bolts.
Yeah.
And that's Tim Burton's Frankenweenie from 1984, the movie that got him fired from Disney.
Yeah, but once Disney learned the error of their ways and made a couple other movies with him.
We got Nightmare Before Christmas, James and the Giant Peach. Was Alice in Wonderland around this time?
I can't remember exactly when Alice in Wonderland came out, but it would have been about this time-ish.
2010. So yes.
Yes. Okay.
So yeah, Alice in Wonderland had came out 2 years earlier, and they're letting Tim Burton have free reign to do whatever he wants, and he's going back, much like he did with Nightmare. For those of you who don't know, Tim Burton wrote a book called The Nightmare Before Christmas while he was working at Disney. So when he came back to Disney, he made a movie based off that book.
Yeah.
So again,
go listen to our episode on Nightmare Before Christmas for more.
Yes. So he's back. Tim Burton is fully back within the Disney fold, and he once again wants to take something that he created and make a full movie out of it. He takes this. It's sort of a reverse of what you think, because usually it's an animated short that becomes a live action movie. This is a live action short that becomes an animated movie.
Yeah, stop motion animation.
Yes, yeah, Tim Burton loves him some stop motion animation. Again, you have Nightmare, James and the Giant Peach, Corpse Bride had just come out a few years previously.
In fact, a lot of the same crew from Corpse Bride worked on this.
It definitely feels like the same art style as Corpse Bride. Nightmare, Corpse Bride, and Frankenweenie have more of an artistic continuity between those three movies than any of them to James and the Giant Peach.
Yeah, the interesting thing is that there is a fan theory that Frankenweenie, Corpse Bride, and Nightmare Before Christmas are all about the same guy at three different points in his life.
I've heard that. I don't buy it, that Victor becomes the character from Corpse Bride, and then he eventually becomes Jack, the Pumpkin King, and his dog has been there the entire time. It's the same dog.
Yeah, because in Corpse Bride and in Nightmare, it's already a dead dog.
Yeah.
At that point. Interestingly enough, Zero's grave is seen in the pet cemetery in the full-length Frankenweenie.
Yeah.
So Tim Burton did throw in a little...
A bone.
a little bone for Zero from Nightmare Before Christmas on there.
Yeah, let's before we get into the animated movie, let's kind of do the quick wrap up. Does Frankenweenie 84 have the magic?
It is an interesting piece to watch, I think, if you are a Tim Burton fan. But unless you are, or if you are a Universal Monsters fan, mm-hmm. you know, one of those two things. If you really know those two things, if not, it's kind of a boring film that not too much happens in. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of character development. There's not a lot of dramatic tension. It's a very amateurish film, which is fine because he was just starting his film career.
Yeah, again,
very obviously it comes off as a student film, a good student film, but a student film.
Again, he had only just graduated from CalArts a few years previously. He'd only worked with Disney, 5 years at this point?
I don't know. He was 26 when he made it.
So yeah, he had done Fox and the Hound. He did some work on Tron. Ironically, he did work on The Black Cauldron.
Yeah, but he was not the lead in any of those.
No.
He was very much the writer, director, you know, he was the everything for Frankenweenie. So if you're really into Tim Burton and want to see where he got started, or you just like parodies of Universal Monster films, it works on both those levels. But just as a film on its own, it's kind of boring and bland. So
if you want
qualifying it that it has the magic, if you're already a fan.
I would say Young Frankenstein is a better parody movie of Frankenstein.
Well, but absolutely.
Yeah, but if you want to go for, you want to see where Tim Burton started his career, I agree. This is a nice, if you're a Tim Burton fan, you want to see where he came, where his start was, yeah. There's some cute moments in this movie that I like it. I would say it does have the magic. But let's get into the final form of this story.
Yeah, final evolution of Frankenweenie.
Let's move on to Frankenweenie 2012, part of our Frankenweenie double feature. Ooh. So, yeah, go ahead. Let's go with this new cast.
Victor, we've got Charlie Tahan, I think is how you pronounce his last name. He is best known for the TV series Ozark. He also was the very, very young Scarecrow in Gotham. And then as the character aged up, they replaced it with a different actor. But he was like the baby Jonathan Crane. Mm. He was also the little kid in I Am Legend. But, you know, still a very young actor. Not a whole lot. Ozark being the kind of big thing he's on because he is a regular on there. Mm. We have, again, as Sparky, our adored Frank Welker.
Frank Welker, he is your childhood. If you need an animal voice, you go to Frank Welker.
Yeah, and he does so beautifully as Sparky in this. All the little, you know, that whole thing is great. Hmm. Martin Short. Everybody loves Martin Short. Everybody knows Martin Short. Comedic genius.
Yeah, we last talked about him in Treasure Planet.
Yep. Back several roles. He is Victor's father. He is Nassor. I don't know how you pronounce his name because they never say his name in the film. I don't think.
I think it is Nassor. Okay. It's pretty much him doing a Boris Karloff impression, and the character looks like a young Boris Karloff.
Yeah, he's got a flat head, and he's very tall, and he's very, you know. And he's also Mr. Burgermeister, the mayor of the town who lives next door. And
Love that reference. The ultimate stop motion reference is the reference to Burgermeister Meisterburger from Santa Claus is Coming to Town. Perfect.
Yeah. I like that he's just Mr. Mayor because that's just what Burgermeister means. But yeah, it is his look is definitely inspired by Santa Claus Coming to Town.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was a Tim Burton thing or if that was just the stop motion people like giving it up for one of the greats. I don't know. But yeah, Martin Short, 3 different roles, and he kills it in all of them.
I honestly couldn't tell that was Martin Short. I could tell it was Martin Short as the father because that's just Martin Short's normal voice. But him doing a Karloff impression and him doing this very, very gruff voice for Mayor.
Yeah, Mr. Mayor.
Yeah.
Yeah. He is brilliant in this. The whole cast is brilliant, by the way. Yeah. We got Catherine O'Hara back. I think
Tim Burton movie with Catherine O'Hara. Yeah.
We talked about her in Nightmare Before Christmas.
Also
she was Sally in that. She was also in Beetlejuice with Tim Burton. So she plays 3 roles as well in this. She plays the mother. She plays a gym teacher that doesn't really have a name. And she's Weird Girl that owns the cat.
Yeah, she has 3 characters. Two of them don't have names.
Yeah, I love that Weird Girl's name is just Weird Girl.
That sounds like something in school. Like, everyone would just call this one Weird Girl, Weird Girl, and no one knows what her name is.
Yeah. Moving on, we have the great Martin Landau, who had worked with Tim Burton before, most famously in the Ed Wood film, where he played Bela Lugosi.
Obviously this, not playing a Bela Lugosi pastiche in this one. You'd think he would be.
No, it's...
Vincent Price.
He talks like Bela Lugosi, because he has that thick Eastern European kind of sound.
But the character is modeled after Vincent Price.
Yeah, but it is supposed to be a Vincent Price type character, which I love. And he does so good. It's Mr. Rizkruski, which I think was just their way of calling him Mr. Rice Krispie. Because that's what I heard when I first watched the movie. I'm like, is his name Mr. Rice Krispie? What are they saying?
That sounds like a joke that Tim Burton would put in there just for himself.
Yeah. Speaking of joke names, we've got Winona Ryder back as a character I love the name of, Elsa Van Helsing.
Van Helsing.
Van Helsing, most people will probably get, but the Elsa is actually a reference to Elsa Lancaster, who played the female monster in Bride of Frankenstein.
And this is before Frozen came out?
Yeah.
So it wasn't quite that Elsa yet.
Yeah, it wasn't. Elsa didn't have that particular connotation to it yet.
Elsa in this movie looks a lot like Lydia from Beetlejuice. Maybe it's just
she
me.
She really is styled very much like Lydia from Beetlejuice, yeah. So and we've got Catherine O'Hara and Winona Ryder back again in another Tim Burton movie. So we've got the amazing acting legend Dee Bradley Baker as Persephone, Shelley, and Colossus. So he just does a bunch of animal noises in this.
Hey, Frank Welker is already taken as a lead. He cannot do the side animals.
Yeah, but we've got Dee Bradley Baker filling in. I think we've talked about Dee Bradley Baker before in some other roles he's had.
Yeah.
We've got an interesting one that I was kind of fascinated to see. There is a character modeled on the character of Edgar Gore. And he is voiced by Atticus Schaefer, who I really, really love in a sitcom called The Middle. But he was also on the Disney Junior series, The Lion Guard. So, you know, he's got some
Disney cred.
Disney, you know, back there working for ABC and working with Disney. He does amazing, by the way, as Igor. So it's such a good performance. We've got Conchita Farrell, who is playing Bob's mother. She is kind of the busybody next door neighbor mother that she hates that all that Victor is getting all the kids into science and stuff and makes a lot of trouble. She's kind of a minor antagonist.
She is based off a character from the short as well.
Yeah, this is one of the few characters that kind of carried over from the short. Is it's very definitely supposed to be the woman who is walking the little dachshund in the short film, except this time they give her a child and make her a bigger part of the film. Mm-hmm. The unfortunate news is that just a few days ago, as we're recording this, Contrada Farrell died, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Passed away at the age of 77. And it was apparently some kind of heart issue. So she will be missed. She is best known as the housekeeper on 2 and a Half Men. That was probably her biggest thing, and she got a couple of Emmy nominations for that, and she was also in L.A. Law, if you ever watched that one. She had a very, very outstanding and lengthy career as a character actress. Very good one.
Probably the most I would say the most craziest of cameos is Christopher Lee as Dracula in a footage from his Dracula movie.
Yeah, Christopher Lee, of course, if you're not a horror fan, you may not know this, but Christopher Lee was very, very well known as one of the stars of the British Hammer Studios horror films, and they were really big when Burton was a kid. They would have been coming out through the 50s, 60s, 70s.
Yeah. Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing.
Yeah, Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing were two of their, you know, major, major stars. And Christopher Lee played Dracula in quite a few of them. And this was, I believe, the first Dracula film that they did. In England, it was just called Dracula. But in the United States, they had to put it out under Horror of Dracula because Universal Pictures owned the Dracula rights for film. So,
it's weird that they had that essentially a clip of a live action movie in this animated movie. Not the last time, because it would also do the same thing for Wall-E, I believe.
Yeah, it really fits in well. And this one, the way they did it, it kind of doesn't pull you out of the film too much, the way they did it. But I just love Christopher Lee and Tim Burton had worked together before, and this was his little homage to Christopher Lee.
It's kind of like in Ed Wood, how he would try to put Bela Lugosi in his movies.
Yeah. It's a very, very, very similar, you know. Tim Burton likes working with people he grew up, you know, admiring, and tried to work with as many of them as he could, which, you know, respect. This movie is just another tiny little bit of background. This movie is kind of interesting because it is the first movie since Mars Attack that Tim Burton had done that had neither Helena Bonham Carter or Johnny Depp in it.
Yeah, those two have become tropes for Tim Burton.
Yeah, well, I mean, he was married to one of them for a while, yeah. So. The interesting thing is that this would be the last horror film that Disney released until 2019, because at the beginning of the year they bought Fox Searchlight Pictures, and one of the movies that was released that year by Fox Searchlight was the movie Ready or Not. Mm. And so that technically made Ready or Not a Disney movie just after the buyout.
Proxy. Yeah.
By proxy. So that but this was the last one they had made under their own banner.
Yeah, and it would make sense for it would make sense that, you know, this straight up has the Walt Disney Pictures logo in it. So yeah, it would be it would make sense for them to do a horror movie for kids.
Yeah, and this is very much a horror movie for kids. It is kind of funny that they said that the original Frankenweenie was too scary for kids, but this one to me I think has more moments that would I would think would scare a little kid.
Yeah.
Other than the idea of the dog dying and the scene with the windmill, there's not really a lot scary in the story. Because when the dog comes back, he's just, he's the same lovable dog.
Yeah.
There's no terror there. Except for from the townspeople.
Yeah, but that's also somewhat in the original story as well.
Oh yeah, it's very faithful to the movie. It's not faithful to the original story. Very faithful to the movie. In that respect, but the full length film has a lot more aspects of straight up horror. A lot more jump scares, a lot more scary imagery, a lot more kind of straight up horror moments.
Yeah. And again, even more homages to Universal horror movies.
Yeah, because there are homages to like The Mummy, to
Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Creature from the Black Lagoon. Godzilla. A lot of them. Not a Universal monster movie, but yeah, we do get some kaiju. Gamera.
Okay. I was going to go into the
Gamera
whole MST3K
really
thing.
Gamera is made of meat.
Yes.
Again,
this one also in black and white.
Tim Burton actually said in an interview that he fought very hard to have this be in black and white, and at told Disney that if they demanded he make it in color, he would just walk away and break the contract.
Tim Burton could afford it.
Yeah, Tim Burton could afford it, even against Disney, I think. But I did like him just kind of standing his ground on it, you know, this. And I think it works really well because it has such a beautiful look to it.
It wasn't just they filmed it in color and tainted it black and white. No, if you go back to the behind the scenes stuff, all the puppets, the marionettes or the maquettes, they're all black and white. The sets are black and white. Everything is black and white.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I've seen not from this movie, but I've seen some of the maquettes they used for Corpse Bride. They're in the Puppetry Museum in Atlanta, which I have visited several times. They have a little scene of them in a set, recreated set from the film, and they're fascinating to look at up close. And they do a really good job of hiding all the joints and stuff so that you can't really see it on camera. And this film, it looks just like 3D animation.
It does.
It looks like computerized animation rather than stop motion. It is so smooth and so perfect, and there's not a single frame of stuttering. And it just, oh, and it does some things that I am shocked you could do in stop motion, like little things like Victor taking gloves off his hands. And stuff
even,
just
making Sparky move like a real dog.
Yeah, he really even, does. The way the he wags his tail and moves his body, and yeah. The animation on this is just superb. And it's just so difficult to believe that it's stop motion. It's so smooth.
I love
There's
the beginning
no stop.
When we get to the one of my favorite parts is like the Disney logo transitioning from color to black and white.
Yeah, it gets like the kind of spooky castle kind of thing with the lightning and everything.
And that, or in the organ version of the ending of When You Wish Upon a Star, it's telling you this is going to be an homage to classic horror movies.
Yeah, and not ones Disney made. Some of this stuff is so specific to the Universal look, I'm kind of surprised they didn't get a lawsuit. I mean, some of this is like, you would think that Universal had a trademark on it or something by now.
A lot of them have become tropes. So much of them are tropes at this point that you can't really specifically sue them over that, because so many people have done it. And,
I absolutely love how they took the story from the short film.
Mm-hmm.
And they put basically the entire story with almost no changes. There are a couple of tweaks from the original story. They just dropped that 30 minutes into this movie and then added an hour of padding around it.
Yeah.
Almost every scene in the short film has a corresponding scene in the feature.
Showed this video to Kiki of someone had compiled scenes from the 84 film and the 2012 film side by side to show people this pretty much is almost a scene for scene remake of that original movie.
But the good thing is, what I was worried about going into this, because I had not seen the feature. Like I said, I loved the short film as a kid. The feature I had not gotten around to seeing, partially because I didn't want it to ruin my memories of the short film. Mm-hmm. But fortunately, that is not an issue. I thought that what they added to the film all felt like it probably should have and would have been in the short film if they could have gotten away with it.
If Burton had more clout to make a full feature rather than a short.
Yeah, I think this is probably what he would have done.
I do like that there's a lot of amateur short amateur stop motion in Victor's film. So you have stop motion characters watching a stop motion movie.
Yeah, and it looks, the styles of stop motion are different. It's a much more amateur style of stop motion that they use to do Victor's film. And I'm going to say that I absolutely love this because as a kid, when we got our first video camera, it came with a stop motion feature. Where you could set it to like the stop motion setting, and when you hit the record button, it would only record like 2 seconds of film and then stop. And then you would hit the record button again, it would record another 2 seconds and stop. And so you didn't have to edit together a stop. You could make a stop motion film in the camera. And I used to do that with action figures and stuff. This was very cute for me to see it because it reminded me of like being a kid and doing that. Except Victor does it with a like 16 millimeter camera, and he has a little editing and splicing studio up in the attic and everything. We see him like physically cutting and repairing film. I love.
Yeah. And we kind of get Victor's, I guess you can kind of hit his catchphrase in this movie is, I can fix that.
Yeah. It's just, he's the kid who fixes things, and he's also said in the film to be a brilliant scientist. His science teacher really does think that he has it in him to be a good scientist when he grows up.
So yeah, this definitely expands the character of Victor, not just being an amateur filmmaker, but an amateur scientist. He actually has a knack for science.
Yeah, He does try his hand at the beginning of the film at baseball a little bit. His father tries to say, hey, maybe you should take up baseball, you know, get out of the house a little bit. And that doesn't go too well.
Yeah, it's another trope of the parent wants their son to be into sports because that's a boy's thing. And not really much of a science. Doesn't like the fact that his son's a nerd, pretty much.
Yeah, it is kind of an interesting scene because he does get his first home run.
In his first ever game, in his first time at bat. Good for Victor.
Yeah, Victor, I mean, good for you. And then, unfortunately, Sparky sees the ball go flying, and he goes, ooh, ball, I'm going to chase it. And
that's how, yeah, we're death number three for Sparky.
You made me watch a dog die 3 times.
Yeah, yeah. But let's kind of backtrack a bit, because it we do get more of the characters. The next door neighbor, you know, we got Mayor Burgermeister, who is like really hating on dogs. Like, he doesn't like that Sparky pees in his lawn. He has his niece Elsa, who he doesn't like that she has a dog.
Yeah, Elsa has the little poodle that is Sparky's love interest.
And we get the introduction of there's something odd about this town, as it seems to be a thunderstorm every night in the town, and there's this weird windmill. We get the foreshadowing of the windmill.
Yeah, the windmill is one of the first things we see in the film. It is the kind of monument on the hill for the town of New Holland.
Yeah, we get some backstory in the town, and they are getting ready for their Dutch Day, because Holland.
Yeah, we're gonna have some tulips and some little Dutch singing girls, you know, Dutch.
Yeah, it's implied that the mayor founded this town and just wants to make it this little piece of Germany, Holland, whatever.
Yeah, Holland. But the interesting thing is that much like you know, we've got the horror trope of it was founded on maybe an old abandoned mine, or maybe a graveyard, or maybe a graveyard where they buried the miners from the abandoned mine. We're not quite sure, but it was founded on something spooky.
Yeah. But yeah, the weird girl is just all, there's something weird about this town. And you get the whole tropes again, like I said, all those tropes. So it's like, there's something up about this town, especially when they say that there's thunderstorms every night. Especially, and they explain that's how their previous science were with us, because he was struck by lightning.
Yeah, and I love that the Martin Landau's first science thing is explaining how the old teacher died.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, he was the conduit for the electricity to go from the sky to the ground. The electricity was always going to go from the sky to the ground, but he got in the way. You know, like. It's such a gruesome opening
the way
science
he said it,
lesson. I love it.
We will combine the ladder. We will complete the circuit. And he was just in the way. It was just, the way he describes it, it just, like, it's this monumentous thing, and he just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah, and Landau really sells it. Like, it's such a good performance.
But the kids make it feel like this is a common occurrence. Even one of the kids say, oh, my parent got struck by lightning twice.
Yeah, everybody in this town seems to get hit by lightning at some point in their life, so it's just a fact of life, I guess. He does the same... he does tell them that there is a science fair coming up. You have to have a partner, apparently. It has to be a partner's competition. And one of the rules is no death race.
Yeah, I like that. That would imply that at some point one of these kids created a death ray for their science project.
Yeah, every rule has an invisible name next to it of the person who tried that. To make them realize, oh crap, we've got to make a rule against this.
Which is and they all have to sign a permission slip to be a part of the science fair. Which is why we get Victor's father saying that to get him to try for the baseball team. It's like, I'll sign the permission slip so you can do the science fair, but you have to try baseball once.
Yeah. And I have a feeling that Victor tried baseball exactly once because of what happened to dear old Sparky.
So in this story, in the short, it was more of an accident because, again, Victor happened to throw the ball a little too far. In this movie, it is entirely on the dad. Like, he did not even want to play baseball, but he had to get into the science fair. If Victor's dad had just said, fine, you can sign up for the science fair, whatever, have fun, and not make him play baseball, Sparky would still be alive. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, so the moral of the story here is, don't play sports, kids. Sports are awful. But after Sparky passes, we get the same scene from before of the frog demonstration.
Mm-hmm.
Much like in the first one, we get the Victor gathering up all the various electrical appliances in the house and going and getting Sparky's body and doing the reanimation, which works. The interesting thing to me about this scene is that they actually put some of the props from the short film into this. They recreated some of the props, like the bicycle generator.
The Christmas reindeers.
Yeah, the Christmas reindeer and stuff like that. That, like, they recreated in miniature all these props from the first film, which I thought was an excellent touch. And we get the lightning storm that comes every night, and he harnesses it to bring back Sparky. I'm going to say something here because I have to. I am fascinated by the story of Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. Not only as a book, but all the various film versions, the parody versions, mm-hmm. Just everything about this story. And when I was doing my graduate work, excuse me, I took a Gothic literature class. Excuse me. And this is one of the... It's a both a Gothic novel and also the first science fiction novel.
Yeah.
So, but if you've ever read the novel, you know that this is not the story of Frankenstein. If you just ask somebody on the street, like, tell me the story of Frankenstein, they're like, well, they stitch a body together, they put lightning into it, it comes to life, it scares the villagers, they end up at a windmill, fire, They'll tell you the story of the 1931 Universal film. And almost everything since that has taken the Universal film as that's just the story of Frankenstein. So even things like this, it's just a parody of that film. But I actually wanted to research the history of why don't we know the original story of Frankenstein? Because some of the things we know, like Igor, mm-hmm. Igor is standing right there next to Victor when he screams, life, give him life, right?
Mm-hmm.
Except he's not. Igor doesn't appear as a character until a little-known sequel called Son of Frankenstein, and Igor is the best-remembered thing from that film. The idea of lightning doesn't come from the book. It actually comes from a theater version of the book that was written like 4 or 5 years after the book came out. So all of the things we think are the basic story of Frankenstein, none of them are in the novel. And so every time I see a Frankenstein story go like electricity and everything, that's not in the book. But it is possible that maybe that would have had something to do with it if Mary Shelley was interested in talking about how the monster was created. But to her, the how was not as important as the why and the what happens after. Mm. So in the actual novel, the creation of the monster is just like two sentences, and it's like, Victor worked very, very hard on this, and one day he found the secret to life and brought his monster to life. Like, that's the entire creation part
of the story.
That
sounds like bad fanfic.
Those are not her exact words. She's a much better writer, of course, but it is about approximately two or three sentences. And it says nothing about how he created the monster, just that he found the secret of life. So the idea of, you know, electricity being so integral to the Frankenstein story still makes me laugh, because it is some forgotten playwright that was a contemporary of Mary Shelley's and saw her book and went like, well, this thing would work good on the stage, but we need that to be a bigger scene, and came up with the idea of electricity because they could like blink the lights or something on stage to do an effect to scare the audience. So that's what they came up with. And I love that. It's one of my favorite pieces of, like, you know, literary history. Tree of, like, where did the lightning come from for Frankenstein. So thank you for indulging me, and that was your literature class for today. You can mark that off on your book. Gone through that course.
So yeah, much like the original short, once Victor goes to school the next day, Sparky gets out and has a little playtime in among the town and causing some people to get scared. He chases around the weird girl's cat, Mr. Whiskers. He sucks on a baby's pacifier.
Yeah, that was a weird scene.
He meets up with Persephone the poodle, Elsa's dog, shocks her, gives her the Stein hair, and, you know, just freaks out the town. And everyone in the town is kind of wondering what's going on, what's been set loose in their little town.
I love that Elsa never seems to question the new hairstyle on her dog.
Well, she already has that Marge Simpson-style hair anyway, the beehive look. So it's just, she put white streaks in her hair because she's a dog, apparently, and dogs can do that.
If my dog gets a piece of lint on his fur, I notice. Like, very tuned into, like, what's going on with my dog's body, you know, to make sure that, like, he doesn't have fleas and, you know, he doesn't have any, like, he's got some skin issues that I have to work out for. But the fact that she'd just come home and her dog has, like, white fur now on both sides of her head for no reason, like, that would be several trips to the vet if that happened to my dog.
Yeah, but Sparky isn't very good at keeping quiet. So Edgar kind of finds out after seeing Sparky run through some of the garbage at school that, why is Sparky alive?
Yeah, and Edgar immediately is like, I can blackmail Victor into being my partner for the science fair.
Yeah. He straight up says it, you know, even before, like, you don't have friends. I don't have friends. You know about science. I don't. We can work together.
Yeah, he is just really into winning this science fair.
And
it's very bizarre.
Every kid in this class is just obsessed with winning the science fair. Like, there's no cash prize. They specifically said it's just a trophy that you get. You don't get any money, you don't get any kind of scholarship, you don't get to go on a trip, you just get a trophy.
It must be a really nice trophy.
Apparently. Yeah, he's straight up like, I know what you did, Victor. And like, Victor's like, I don't know what you're talking about. Your dog's alive. No, Sparky's dead. He can't be alive. So,
yeah, I love the way that Igor delivers those lines, the actor delivers those lines.
Yeah. And so, in order to keep his own mouth shut, he wants Victor to tell him how he brought Sparky back from the dead, and even Victor himself doesn't quite understand how it worked. All he knows is some sort of combination of wind and lightning. So they try to recreate the experiment. So Igor goes to the pet shop, buys a fish, does something to it, I assume.
No, he buys a dead goldfish. Because the guy asks him which goldfish he wants in the tank, and he points and he says, that one, just as a dead goldfish, like, rises up to on its belly.
Oh, okay. I must have missed that part. I thought it was already alive. So he buys a dead goldfish, and then they reanimate it. Only the experiment doesn't quite go the same way as it did before, because the goldfish is now invisible.
And very scary.
It's almost piranha-like in its demeanor.
Yeah. I really love the effect. It's all kind of done with shadows and all that kind of stuff. But the effect of the invisible, terrifying goldfish skeleton, it's one of my favorite in the movie. I love it.
Yeah, and like they're not sure why this happened. What the science is, because they don't know what they're doing. Victor kind of knows, but he doesn't really know all of it. Sparky hates this. He's just growling at this goldfish. Like, he knows something's wrong here.
Igor, though, is immediately like, sweet, invisible goldfish.
That's my science project. I'm going to use this to win the science fair.
And Igor, despite saying that he wouldn't tell, immediately goes and tells, like, all of his classmates.
Like,
but unfortunately, the goldfish doesn't last very long.
Yeah, within a day, the goldfish ceased to be for the second time. It's just an empty jug of water with no invisible goldfish, and which kind of brings up the ire of his classmates, because now they think that they tricked him and lied to him about having an invisible goldfish. So Igor goes to Victor saying, yeah, I don't think these reanimated animals are meant to last.
Which, of course, freaks Victor out because, you know, Sparky.
Yeah. So far, Sparky seems to be stable. I mean, there's a scene where he kind of runs low on juice and they have to literally plug up a car charger to get him back going.
Yeah, it's a cute little scene, and they redo the water spurting out of his neck seams.
Yeah, from the original short.
But, you know, now that the classmates don't believe in the invisible goldfish anymore, they have to come up with something new. And two of them, Toshiaki and Bob, decide to try to make a jetpack, but using like plastic soda bottles. Like, the power of carbonation will lift this kid off the ground.
It's almost like Alka-Seltzer and soda.
Yeah, it's the Mentos and soda kind of reaction they're going for, but they put him on roller skates on the roof and try to send him off, and all it does is pushes him off the roof and he breaks his arm.
Yeah, yeah, this was what starts the big town meeting to be anti-science, an entire American town going against science that has no relevance in 2020.
Nope. I do say that one of my favorite lines in the movie comes at this point, because they ask Martin Landau's teacher to come out and speak for himself, to explain himself. And he was like, oh, I can explain this very easily. You're all ignorant. And then he's like, wait, is ignorant the right word? Because it's very obvious that English is not his first language. And then he goes, I mean, that you are stupid, you are dumb, you do not have the intelligence to understand science.
Yeah, and even the verbiage he uses, I understand, you know, anyone who watches this movie kind of understand what he's trying to say, but he says it with such a visceral tone, the word thing he used, like, I'm trying to get to their brains, in his way of saying, I'm trying to get them to think, but as the wording he uses and the tone of voice he uses is making the townspeople think that he's literally going to rip the brains out of their children's heads.
Yeah, I'm trying to crack open their skulls and remove the brains, you know.
So he's fired.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and the gym teacher is now the new science teacher, and she isn't really science-y.
I love that when the students question her on that, like, but what do you know about science? And her response is just, more than you. And, man, I think we all had that type of teacher at some point in school, right?
Yeah, a teacher who clearly didn't know anything of what they're actually teaching. They're doing it, you know, it's a job. They were told to teach this class. But
if you took the textbook away from them, they would fail the test. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, but, I had so many of those teachers.
But Victor has kind of grown fond of Mr. Rice Krispies over here. And he doesn't like the fact that he's been fired. And, you know, he wants at least one last bit of advice from him. He kind of tells him what's been going on. Hey, I've been working on my science project. The first time I did it, it worked. It worked great. But the second time I did it, I got a different result. Well, you changed a variable. The first time you did it with passion. The second time you did it to get it over with. So
yeah.
Science can so be used. Yeah.
The variable in here is love, you know, and they kind of suggested it in the short film, but it's very explicitly stated here. Like, you have to love the animal you're bringing back or things will go horribly wrong.
You have to actually have passion in your project, otherwise the project will fail.
Yeah.
That is the wording that the science teacher is saying, but it's pretty much Sparky was brought back through the power of love.
Yeah.
It fits a Disney movie, honestly. It's Disney. It fits. That doesn't sound like a Tim Burtonism. That sounds like a Disneyism.
I think the idea of doing projects that you're passionate about, I think, is very much Tim Burton, because when's the last time that you watched a Tim Burton movie and thought he was phoning this in?
Dumbo.
Exactly. You know, it's like, and was that a very good movie? Not really.
No.
You know, but all the ones that you can see came from his particular desire, like Frankenweenie.
Mm-hmm.
They all turned out pretty good. I mean, they've got flaws in them. There are things that maybe you might have done different or you know, that maybe they didn't have time or money to do. But, you know, you look at all the classic Tim Burton movies, and it's very obvious that these were his passion projects.
Even Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, even Alice in Wonderland, you can tell that he had some sort of passion for doing these stories.
Yeah. They didn't turn out particularly good, but I would say that both of those movies are on some level better than Dumbo.
Yeah.
I really did not feel any passion from Dumbo. Anyway.
Yeah. Anyway, so after school, all of the class is kind of picking on poor Igor over here, you know, trying to, you know, are you trying to make us look like fools with your goldfish trick? No, Victor really brought him back. Victor did it. He brought his dog back. Oops.
Yeah. Thanks, Igor.
Yeah. And at the same time, this time it's Victor's mom that discovers Sparky instead of the dad.
Yeah, and she immediately freaks out.
As you would if you just saw your dead dog come back to life.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. No shame there.
Yeah.
But, you know, the dad hears the commotion, comes to see. The Victor runs in and tries to calm Sparky down, but Sparky escapes and runs out into town thinking that nobody loves him.
The beautiful scene is that you see Sparky running into a mirror, and it's almost this is the first time he's ever seen his own reflection since he came back from the dead. He sees the stitching on himself. He sees himself with the bolt in his neck, and it's like, oh my god, I'm a monster.
Yeah. But he runs back to the graveyard and finds his grave and curls up on his grave.
Mm, poor puppy.
In possibly the saddest freaking scene in the whole movie. Oh. But
and again, we also get the same kind of discussion between Victor and his father, you know, do you know what you've done? The ramifications of all this.
Yeah, and once again, Victor is like, dog. Dog is the ramifications of this. I love my dog.
And
which,
they,
you know.
Yeah, they agree to go find Sparky. Meanwhile, the Dutch Day Festival is going on.
Which... And several other classmates have decided they're going to try to do this experiment themselves.
Yeah, they see that Victor and his family have left the house and apparently have left the door unlocked. So they're going
in.
Yeah,
they find his notes.
Igor says, I don't understand all of this. And then you see his classmates, but we do.
Yeah.
Because they're like Victor, they are also scientists or junior scientists or something. They're
yeah,
very
I wonder if this is like the science magnet school or something in the area.
Yeah. Yeah.
The two women that are talking, one of the most interesting throwaway lines in the movie is that the two women with the babies from the pacifier scene we kind of glossed over earlier, if you actually listen to what they're saying in their chatter while the stuff is going on with the dog and the baby, they're talking about how they're kind of uncomfortable in the town, and it's a weird town, but the schools are so good. Which is why they've come there to raise a family.
The education system in New Holland is the best, apparently.
Yeah, apparently.
So, yeah, now that all of the kids in the classroom have discovered the secret to bringing animals back from the dead, each student is going to try their best to recreate the experiment. Two of them go to the pet cemetery, the same pet cemetery that Sparky ran up to get their dearly departed animals. Tokiyashi gets his turtle Shelly.
Named after Mary Shelley.
Yeah. That is a great reference, but it sounds like a name that a kid would give his turtle.
Yeah, but we see the name written on the grave and it's spelled EY at the end, just like Mary Shelley spelled her name, you know, her last name was spelled. So it's very, very obviously a reference there.
Nasor gets his pet gerbil Colossus, and I love the name on that.
Yeah, and this I love the way this is set up, because he goes to the largest crypt, and he says, like, oh, Colossus. And it's this giant crypt in the middle of a pet cemetery, too.
The tomb of Colossus, you will rise again.
Yeah, and then eventually, like, when he brings the thing back, you hear, like, doom, doom, doom. Doom, and then you see like the little mummified hamster. It's one of the best jokes in the movie, and I absolutely love everything about it.
And again, it's something a kid would name their tiny, tiny pet Colossus.
Yeah.
Igor gets a rat out of the dumpster.
Yeah. The weird girl finds a dead bat somewhere.
Well, actually, Mr. Whiskers finds the dead bat.
Oh, okay. I missed that part. But the she has a dead bat that she's going to try to bring back to life. And Bob decides to go for sea monkeys that he has dumped into his pool.
Does that count? Do the sea monkeys count as dead?
No. I mean, they're generally like frozen brine shrimp eggs. So.
Yeah. So, yeah, he... And so they all do the experiment with the electricity, and the visual of four kites in the air.
All being hit by lightning at the same time, yeah.
Yeah.
But we discover that just like love was the main ingredient in the first experiment that brought Sparky back, these kids are doing it out of a sense of like ambition and competition, and that causes their experiments all to go horribly, horribly wrong in various ways.
Well, with Shelly, once the lightning hits, he also gets hit with a big tub of Miracle-Gro. Like, they
I wonder how much they had to pay for that branding.
Yeah, I mean, they couldn't just say plant grower or plant food. It specifically said had to say Miracle-Gro.
Yeah, but, it is absolutely a Miracle-Gro can with the name spelled the same way and everything, yeah.
Yeah, and that's what causes Gamera Shelley to start walking around. And they even have Godzilla-style music as Shelley is walking around. Dun, 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 dun!
Yeah, and Shelley has a scream that is very similar to the Godzilla roar.
Yeah, even though it is a turtle and it's supposed to be Gamera, but not Gamera, a lot of people.
Yeah, anyway.
Yeah, not Godzilla's more well-known than Gamera, let's admit that.
Yeah, and but then, Gamera is more tasty.
Yes. and the Igor's rat turns into sort of a werewolf pastiche.
Yeah.
And Mr. Whiskers is biting on the bat as it's being struck by lightning. So the bat explodes, but in a very much a Spider-Man style transference of DNA as Mr. Whiskers becomes part bat.
Yeah, which I love. Like, the transformation scene of Mr. Whiskers is amazing.
Meanwhile, Dutch Day is going on still, and poor Elsa has to sing, I assume, the New Holland theme song.
Yeah.
In this Dutch girl outfit.
Wait, we didn't get to the other two monsters. Because there's two more monsters we didn't go through.
The sea monkeys.
Sea monkeys.
Which are very much in the style of the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah, they all turn into these tiny little, like, humanoid kind of monsters that interestingly resemble a horror version of the sea monkey artwork that you used to find in sea monkey ads in comic books in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
So I love that they threw that nod in there, because that was the biggest letdown for kids in the 50s and 60s, that they would see, like, you know, Sea Monkey Kingdom, you know, grow your own sea monkeys and everything. There'd be this little illustration of these, like, humanoid kind of creatures, and then they'd get them and they'd be like really tiny little brine shrimp. They'd be like, oh, I got ripped off.
Yeah.
So. And then the last one is, of course, Colossus, the mummy hamster.
Yeah.
Which I love. Monsters are on the loose now, and the entire town is at the New Holland Day Festival.
Yeah, and to backtrack a bit, it's like, you can tell Elsa does not want to be there, but because she's the mayor's niece, she is like, has to be the poster child of this town holiday.
Yeah, and they put her in a silly costume. They put lit candles on her hat,
which she does not like. Like, don't worry, we got the fire department here, and this old fire department guy. And it's like, you know how many kids would kill to be in your position? I welcome death. And she says that into the microphone, and the entire town hears her say that.
I need that clip as like my ringtone or something, you know, whenever I get a text message.
That is very much completely Lydia Deetz.
Yeah.
That is Winona Ryder at her inner Winona Ryderist.
Yeah.
And she sings. I don't know if this is actually Winona Ryder singing, but even if it is, the fact that it's a little girl singing and it's bad singing actually endears the song a bit. Because here's this kid who doesn't want to sing, probably can't sing, and just she would rather be anywhere else than singing this song right now. Modest houses at modest prices. I was like, really? That's your town song?
Yeah, it's very. I always love that Tim Burton's films are frequently a rejection of the suburban white bread American dream. As a lot of horror films in the 80s were. Mm-hmm. You know, that's where you get stuff like Halloween. You know, it's like, oh, you think the suburbs are safe? Nope. Yeah. You know. So I respect that as a kind of pointed bit of satire.
And as she finishes her song, all of the pets attack the festival. You have a giant, we have a were-rat, you have a giant turtle, you have a swarm of sea monkeys and a crawling hamster.
Yeah, tiny little hamster that roars at things. Roar!
Yeah, and Mayor Burgermeister, Burgermeister and the gym teacher just running into each other, getting chased by these monsters. And just, like, if you didn't like Mayor Burgermeister before, the fact that he shoves his own niece in front of him as he runs away.
Yeah, he's not a good guy.
The entire town being harassed by these monsters. The showdown. I gotta talk about the showdown. Because as Tokiyashi and Nessor meet eye to eye and their pets meet eye to eye for this epic showdown, and the music swells up and Nessor says, "Go, Colossus! Kill! Kill!" And we don't even get into the first round. Poor Colossus, rest in peace for the second time, squashed by Shelly's foot.
Yeah, Shelly just looks down at the hamster and just steps on it, and we just get this, like, crunch.
And I love that the music just powers down, like, meow. It's like the person doing the music was expecting this big epic fight scene, and it's set up like this big epic fight scene, and the you just get the rug pulled out of you, and that is probably one of the funniest moments in the movie.
Yeah.
Colossus?
My favorite one, it's less funny, but it's kind of my favorite, is that they discover that since the sea monkeys were put in fresh water, they can't stand salt. And so they attack them with popcorn.
It seems like a scene right out of Gremlins.
It really does. This had a very Gremlins feel to me as well, yeah. And when salt touches them, they go to bang. And explode. Yeah,
well, they find this out by seeing one of the sea monkeys eat popcorn and then die.
Yeah, so they kill the rest of them.
With popcorn!
The same way.
Yeah.
Yep, with popcorn. I mean, death by popcorn is not such a bad way to go, if you ask me.
No. And we get Shelly,
The rat! The rat is the next one to go, and that one, tries to attack Sparky. And ends up hitting the bolt on Sparky's neck and getting shocked by it, and that kills it.
It actually literally reverts back into a dead rat, which gives Victor the idea that the same way they were brought to life, they could be killed again.
Yeah.
And poor Takeyashi, he's trying to film this he's trying to be another amateur filmmaker. Only he's almost eaten by Shelly. How dare you do this to me? I gave you life!
Yeah. But Victor ends up saving Takeyashi by having Shelly step in a puddle of beer, which he then electrocutes.
Yeah, the sea monkeys poured out all the beer. Shelly steps into the beer. He throws a down power line onto the beer. You can tell what happens when water meets electricity. And again, rest in peace, Shelly. Much like when Colossus was killed, you had Tokiyashi going, Shelly?
Yeah, because these were actually their pets. The other kids had just brought back random things, but these two kids had brought back their presumably beloved pets.
Although it wasn't under the pretense of love, but more of, I'm going to win the science fair with this.
Yeah. But still, it's kind of sad.
Yeah.
That leaves the bat cat.
Yeah. The vampire cat.
Which ends up flying in and picking up poor Persephone the poodle.
Yeah.
And carrying her off toward the windmill.
No reason why they get to do it, because they need to be there.
Yeah, we got to get to the windmill somehow. Sparky. Elsa and Victor immediately start running, and Sparky decides to go get the parents for help, Victor's parents for help.
And he has his he grabs Elsa's wig that she was wearing on stage, and the parents get the wrong idea that Sparky has attacked and possibly killed Elsa.
Well, the townsfolk do. Victor's parents are on Sparky's side, but the townsfolk, led by Mr. Burgermeister, are immediately like, this monster dog killed my Elsa.
And in another nod to Frankenstein, this time they're actually carrying torches. Lit torches.
Yeah, they all have torches at this point. For no particular reason, but I
for
love
the
it.
For the Frankenstein homage, really.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they all, Sparky leads them all to the windmill. Mayor Burgermeister is yelling at them, where's my niece? Where's my niece? What did you do to her? And then did they tie up poor Sparky, thinking that he had done something? And he's done nothing. He's been a good boy. He gets a little mischievous, but he's been a good boy this whole time.
Yeah.
And much like
much like last time, one of the torches sparks up the windmill.
Yep. This time, not only is Victor there, but Elsa is there as well. Elsa is trying to get out of there with her dog, being chased by this vampire bat or vampire cat, and just almost falls to her doom.
Yeah, Victor and Sparky are trying to save her. Victor is trying to pull her to safety while Sparky battles Mr. Whiskers.
Boss battle!
Yeah. They're able to, Victor is able to get a rope and lower Elsa onto the ground along with Persephone. So Elsa and Persephone are safe, but Victor and Sparky are still trapped inside. And unlike the short film, this time the parents are actively trying to get in there.
Yeah,
physically having to restrain Victor's father as he's screaming, "No, my son's in there," which is, finally what a parent would hopefully do.
And much like the original Sparky, Victor is knocked out as he is knocked out by Mr. Whiskers. Sparky pulls him out and saves Victor's life. But this time, Mr. Whiskers pulls Sparky back into the windmill, and he doesn't just back into it like in the short. And the two continue the never-ending battle between cats and dogs, which is ended by a piece of the windmill falling and just harpooning itself right through Mr. Whiskers.
Well, it's a stake to the heart. I mean, how else do you kill a vampire?
Stake to the heart to kill anything.
But this is a gruesome image.
And really,
I mean, as a still frame, it is a gruesome image because it's the wood has fallen in and impaled itself in the ground, but Mr. Whiskers' body is like hovering dead, impaled on the wood mid-flight, and Sparky is like surrounded by flames looking up at the corpse and stuff. Like, as a single frame, that is a terrifying image.
And the windmill collapses on top of the both of them. Death number 4 for Sparky.
You made me watch a dog die 4 times.
Yeah, and this time we get a bit of a mirror of the beginning scene where in the short we just see Victor kind of shocked stand still as the windmill falls. Now we get Victor going, "No!" Much like he did earlier in the movie.
Yeah. But as in the short film, the townspeople have finally learned their lesson after almost roasting a kid. And yeah. They circle their cars around and they're all like, "Hey, we can do it. He did it before. We can do it now." You know, and they do the same trick with the car batteries.
Only this time, at first, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And Victor is content with it. He says, "It's okay, boy. You don't have to come back this time." It's almost like he's accepting of his dog's passing this time. Which would have been fine if they hadn't copped out and had to redo the ending of the original short. Because Sparky is once again alive. It just took him a little bit. I think they just needed that one little, like earlier, it needed that little bit of love from Victor. The power of love Because, again, this is a Disney movie. And Sparky is fine. Sparky is, again, alive. And much like the ending of the short, Persephone and Sparky have their little moment.
Nose to nose, sparks nope. between them, literally.
Literal sparks. And that ends the movie.
Yeah.
So let's... So that wraps up the 2012 version of Frank and Weenie. So as someone who never saw the full feature, what's your opinion?
I was really, really surprised at how much I liked this. I like I said, I was really worried that it was going to taint my memories of the original. But doing the rewatch of the original and then watching this one, this is by far the superior version of the story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Burton is now a confident filmmaker with, you know, decades of experience behind him. He's got his style, he's got his viewpoint, and it all works really well. The humor landed. Like almost every joke in this, I found myself laughing at. Mm-hmm. I loved the extra homages to various things.
We did kind of skip over another one. Is right after Colossus dies, Nacer falls into some decorations of Dutch Day and gets wrapped up like a mummy and falls into one of a sort of a sarcophagus looking display of stuff.
Yeah. There,
again, there Boris Karloff in the mummy. That's so, like, by default, Nacer looks like Boris Karloff in Frankenstein, but by the end, he looks like Boris Karloff in the mummy.
Yeah. The interesting thing is that I just love all the little bits.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is one of those that the parts are greater than the sum at this point, because they're all just so really interesting and lovely. And this one is a little less horror and a little more heart for Tim Burton.
Yeah, again, like earlier, this really does put forward the power of love between a boy and his dog versus it was a science experiment that worked.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would show this to like a little kid, because the dog death might be a little too much for them. But, you know, you got like a 12-year-old or something.
I would say this is like the next step. If you'd already shown them Nightmare Before Christmas and they're fine, sure, you can show them this.
Yeah. There are some jump scares with some of the reanimated animals, the monster one. But it's not too scary. I mean, I think it's like a PG film or something, so you know, it's not that bad. It's very much a kid's film, but it's also like really enjoyable. It's not super deep. You know, it's not like really philosophical or anything, but if you want like an adorable film about a kid who really loves his dog.
Which is, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's one of the reasons I wanted you to do this one for Halloween is just this is really does fit. Then again, you know, most of Tim Burton's movies fit for Halloween. It's just, yeah, most of them just are in that style. So it's like, if you have a kid, it's not like you're really going to go out for Halloween this year. So if
at,
you have a kid...
At least you shouldn't.
You shouldn't. So yeah, you know, this, Nightmare Before Christmas, whatever classics they have on Disney Plus from their Halloween section. I don't know why they put Haunted Mansion in there. It's not a Halloween classic. No, I don't care what they say.
It's not a classic of any.
No. But, you know, if you're home Halloween and you want some stuff with your small ones, it's not, there are worse movies you can choose than Frank and Weenie. And it's a nice introduction.
Also, for a horror film, this is a beautiful film.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just think this is the most beautiful film. I love everything about this, the production design and the technical aspects of it and everything, just really impressive.
Of the four stop motion Tim Burton movies, this actually looks the best of the four.
It really does. I mean, technically speaking, this is the best. Some of the other ones have better stories, but this is the best looking, I think.
Yeah.
So yeah, magical. Definitely, go watch it.
Definitely has the magic to me. So let's move on to what we're doing next week. I put a spell on you. Yes, we are going to Salem, Massachusetts to definitely go for the classic. That is a classic, Hocus Pocus. So we're going to be talking Bette Midler, and we're going to be talking Sarah Jessica Parker and Kathy Najimy.
Yeah, this movie is the entire reason we did this month. It was all building to this.
So yeah, so tune in next week for Hocus Pocus. Go see Frankenweenie if you haven't seen it yet. And that's we are wrapping up of Halloween for this year. And we will talk to you all later. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Rewatching the Magic. We invite you to keep the magic going by joining the conversation online. Find us on Facebook at Rewatching the Magic, on Twitter at Rewatch the Magic, and of course, find all new episodes at rewatchingthemagic.podbean.com. Until next time, remember, the magic is for everyone. It only stops if you let it.